It is Thursday, October 26, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, regional leaders say Catalonia will not hold snap elections. Files on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy will be released today. And legendary musician Fats Domino dies at the age of 89. It's all ahead. President Carlos Puigdemont has ruled out the possibility of holding a regional snap election and has asked Parliament to decide how to move forward as the succession crisis from Spain continues. During an announcement which was delayed, canceled, and rescheduled Thursday, Puigdemont said that there were not enough guarantees from Madrid that a snap election would stop the imposition of direct rule in Catalonia. Earlier Thursday, Puigdemont said the Spanish government will worsen the political crisis over the Catalonia region's push for independence if lawmakers go ahead with a threat to revoke its autonomy. Monash University senior lecturer Carlos Uxo tells International Edition's Victor Beatty such a snap election wouldn't have been enough to dissuade the Senate from voting to dismiss the regional government and imposing direct rule.
To be approved, you need the majority in the Senate, and the ruling party, the Partido Popular, has that majority, so they don't even need to discuss with other parties. They have said that it will go ahead no matter what the Catalan government does. And yes, it will be happening on Saturday.
Could this all have been avoided? Both sides apparently have played this badly. Is that your view?
It is my view, and I have the feeling that it's the view of the majority of people in Spain, and I'm afraid also the majority of people in Catalonia. In the last week, the Catalan government, or the president of the Catalan government, received an invitation to speak in the Senate, but even the setting when he could speak became an issue, which means that basically neither of both sides are really ready to engage in a real dialogue. I think they are more interested at this stage in defending their views rather than trying to come out of this stalemate.
Carlos, Catalan authorities have been rather cagey or murky in declaring this independence. Have they, in fact, declared independence or not?
Well, that is the most difficult question to be answered. Carles Puigdemont, the Catalan president, gave a speech that probably will be studied in the future as an example of how not to say what you want to say, but you are saying what you don't want to say at the same time. In the end, nobody knew if he had declared independence. I think that, to some extent, it could have been seen as a good political move, trying to delay a final decision to try to engage in more dialogue, but that has not eventuated. The fact is that not in the parliament, but outside in another session, a parallel session, parliamentarians, members of three parties in Catalonia, they did sign a declaration of independence. The document is there, it is signed, it just needs to be validated.
Carlos Uxo said once direct rule is imposed, the Spanish government is expected to call for new elections within 6 months. The question is, will Catalans take part in a vote not called by the regional government? He said while the specter of violence is growing, he believes the objective of even the most ardent secessionist is to win the battle of international public opinion by showing that this is a peaceful, democratic struggle. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, it's a busy day here in Washington. A lot of stories going on here that are trending, starting with the U.S. House of Representatives passing the president's budget proposal, 216 votes to 212, so a very narrow majority voting for that. 20 Republicans voted against this proposal, and there are vows now on social media to vote out those Republicans who voted against it. There are cheers from the right and President Trump's supporters saying that this is a legislative achievement that is moving forward and he's getting things done. And there's a lot of criticism from the left and President Trump's opponents about the details of this tax plan, saying that it unfairly targets or doesn't help middle-class American citizens. Another big story today in Washington, new allegations of sexual harassment and assault against two big names, including a former president. Mark Halperin, who is a big political reporter, has been accused of sexual harassment and sexual assault by several women. He's made a statement saying he's stepping aside from his position at NBC News, where he works. And former President George Bush coming out and apologizing after two women said that he made some inappropriate comments to them and had some inappropriate touching. This is all something that social media is referring to as the Weinstein effect. We've talked about how big Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein being charged with all of these different allegations of sexual assault and harassment. They say that this is encouraging more women to come forward with their stories, and that's why we're hearing about more of these cases. So that's a big topic of conversation on social media. But perhaps the biggest thing going on in Washington today, a story I know that you're going to have a little later on in the show, the JFK files. Because after decades of being classified, the final files pertaining to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy will be released today, nearly 54 years after the assassination on November 22nd, 1963. There was a law that required these files to be released within 25 years that was passed back in 1992. And so that's why they're being released now. I know one person who's excited to see these files is President Trump. He said the long-anticipated release of the hashtag JFK files will take place tomorrow. So interesting, that tweet coming yesterday. And Larry Sabato, who is a well-known political scientist, tweeting out a photo of his students at the University of Virginia, where he's a professor. He says that they're ready for the documents to be released so they can pore over them. It's over 3,000 files, so a lot of documents to go through. But he says he has a team of 14 students there who are going to look through all those documents. And in the broader sense of social media, a lot of conspiracy theorists. This has been something that's been talked about for decades. And so a lot of history buffs and conspiracy theorists are looking to get their hands on these and pour through the information once they're released.
Yeah, it should be fascinating.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Twitter blocks Russian media advertisements. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has no role in Syria's future. U.S. defense officials brief lawmakers on a recent attack in Niger. And Vice President Pence says the U.S. is shifting relief funds for persecuted minorities in the Middle East from the United Nations to the United States Agency for International Development. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Curiosity rover has been providing scientists with valuable new insights on Mars since it landed inside the red planet's Gale crater on August 5, 2012. Among the rover's exploratory functions was its ability to drill into Martian rock to gather samples for analysis by its laboratory instruments. But mission officials say Curiosity's drill feed mechanism stopped working reliably in December 2016 as it was about to perform another sample collection. Mission technicians have been working since then to restore the rover's sample drilling capability. While it may be at least several more months from resuming drilling operations, the mission's crew says they are making progress and were able to touch the Martian surface with the drill for the first time in 10 months on October 17th. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the ancient art of paper folding becomes engineer's dream in space. Well, as we heard earlier, a final batch of government documents related to the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy is expected to be released today, perhaps shedding new light on a tragic event that has fascinated the public and JFK experts for decades. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports from Washington.
President Kennedy was assassinated while riding through Dallas, Texas, with his wife Jackie on November 22, 1963. Secret Service agent Clint Hill rushed to the presidential limousine seconds after the final shot struck the president.
I thought it must have been a fatal wound, but I didn't know for sure. The only thing Mrs. Kennedy said was, Jack, what have they done? And then she said, Jack, I love you.
Lee Harvey Oswald, a former defector to the Soviet Union, was charged with Kennedy's killing.
Did you shoot the president?
I didn't shoot anybody, no, sir.
Oswald was gunned down 2 days later by nightclub owner Jack Ruby, fueling fears of a possible conspiracy. President Donald Trump announced in a tweet that he would permit the final batch of JFK files to be released, subject to review. A full release of documents could shed new light on Kennedy's murder, says expert Larry Sabato.
It will be a significant moment because finally, after nearly 54 years, researchers will have all the information that the government has had and be able to reevaluate the Kennedy assassination.
In particular, Sabato and other experts want to know what various government agencies knew and shared about Oswald's visits to the Soviet and Cuban embassies in Mexico City prior to the assassination.
I want to learn more about what they really knew in advance and why, if we can find out from the documents, they weren't willing to communicate more with one another.
The official Warren Commission report concluded Oswald acted alone, but the public has long been skeptical, says Sabato.
The proportion of Americans believing in a conspiracy has ranged from 60% to 75%. So it's pretty clear that most Americans don't believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
Despite the skepticism, no conclusive evidence has yet to surface to suggest anyone other than Oswald was involved in the assassination. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Paper folding, known as origami, is widely considered a Japanese art form. From a single piece of paper, an animal, a flower, or even a boat can take shape. Besides the fun and artistic side of origami, the art of paper folding also has applications that can take it to outer space. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California.
You may have heard of elephant seals.
Robert Salazar has been folding origami since he was 8 years old.
This is one of my first.
When he sees a sheet of paper, he gets excited.
Seeing the single uncut sheet, it has everything you need to create all of the origami that have ever been folded. It's all in the single sheet, so there's endless potential.
That endless potential reaches all the way to space. Salazar's skill at origami is now being used to help create objects that may one day be used in space.
Origami offers the potential to take a very large structure, even a vast structure, and you can get it to fit within the rocket, go up, and then deploy back out again. So it greatly magnifies what we're capable of building in space.
Folding an object the size of a baseball diamond so that it could fit into a rocket is the goal of a NASA project called Starshade. Once it opens up in space, Starshade would allow a space telescope to better see the planets around bright stars.
Seeing an exoplanet next to its parent star is like trying to image a firefly next to a searchlight, the searchlight being the star. And Starshade seeks to block out that starlight so you can image a really faint exoplanet right next to it.
Origami is also used in robot design. This robot, called the Pop-Up Flat Folding Explorer Robot, has a body that can fold itself flat. It has been tested on desert terrains and snowy slopes.
All right, go right up that hill.
And may one day end up on a mission to another planet.
It's to explore environments that otherwise would be inaccessible to a robot that couldn't fold itself to fit inside these cracks. Explore, you know, cave systems on, could be other planets, even on our own.
Another application for space origami design is to pack an antenna, such as this one, into satellites the size of a briefcase called CubeSats.
The bigger the antenna you have, the more gain your antenna has. So it is useful to have a big antenna that gets packaged into this tiny space that then unfolds out to be a large antenna. The biggest CubeSat antennas we have right now are about half a meter.
Origami-inspired technology does not have to stop at these objects.
So often, origami design has been tailored towards materials that are already are lying flat. But there's actually a vastly, I think, much larger field of applications for which the surfaces are not flat, so they could be parabolic, they could be spherical.
When it comes to origami, Salazar says art, science, and engineering are quite similar. They draw on making observations and creating something that produces an impact. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Pasadena, California.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
Rock and roll's greatest, Fats Domino, died of natural causes this week. He was 89 years old. Nikki Strong of VOA One is here to talk about his life and music. Tell us about Fats Domino's legacy.
Well, he was one of the mighty architects of rock and roll, one of its biggest stars, hands down. He was actually Elvis Presley's main rival. By the end of his career, Domino sold more records than any other 1950s rocker, except for Elvis Presley. And there's an interesting story with Elvis that he and Fats Domino were in the same room together. The press were interviewing Elvis, and one reporter refers to Elvis as the king. And he interrupts the reporter, and he points to Fats Domino, and he says, "There's the real king of rock and roll." And he also, I think in one of his shows in Las Vegas, it was, he started his concert by saying, "This gentleman," he introduced Fats Domino, and he said, "This gentleman was a huge influence on me when I started out." And Fats Domino was a critical influence on music in general of the 1960s and 70s. His million-selling debut single, The Fat Man, on Imperial Records, has been cited as the first rock and roll record to achieve that level of sales success. He was from New Orleans, and so the sounds of New Orleans informed his music, especially the syncopated second line rhythms, which is usually associated with the brass band parades in New Orleans. He was also known for his boogie-woogie piano. That was a major influence of his music. And he had his trademark triplets. And these triplets became so popular that they wound up being copied in so many rock and roll ballads at the time. It's like they became standard. Like, you had to have a triplet, you know, and he popularized that technique. He was also one of the first R&B artists to cross over and gain popularity with white audiences. He helped create one of the first R&B songs to cross over to the pop chart, Lottie Miss Claudie. Because his shows attracted both whites and blacks, his music became a factor in the breakdown of racial segregation in the U.S. And many white artists got huge boost in their careers by recording his hits, you know, as well. So case in point, in 1955, Ain't It a Shame became a number one hit for Pat Boone as Ain't That a Shame. And he would also just also cover other songs and make it his own and put his own stamp on it. Blueberry Hill, for example, was not one of his original songs. It was first done in 1940. It had been recorded by Glenn Miller and Louis Armstrong, but his version in 1956, complete with those triplets, became humongous. It was huge. And he was also known for just singing like wordless lyrics, like wah, 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 and woo, and he did it like nobody else can. So, yeah, a rich legacy indeed.
Well, he started his career as a teenager.
He did. He grew up around music. He was the child of Haitian Creole plantation workers and the grandson of a slave. His brother-in-law, Harrison Verrett, is a traditional jazz musician and gave him one of his first piano lessons. And from there, it was history. He fell in love and devoted himself to the craft. So he was primarily self-taught. He studied a lot of the boogie-woogie hits at that time, a lot of the boogie-woogie legends. He would teach himself how to play everyone's records, he said. He would hear it and he would learn how to play it. And he taught himself a lot by ear. He said he had a good ear for catching notes. He dropped out of school in fourth grade. He worked as an Iceman helper. And he said in houses where there were pianos, he would play. And that is actually how he practiced. In his teens, he started working at a club called The Hideaway. The Hideaway, with a band led by the bassist Billy Diamond, who nicknamed him Fats. That's where he got his nickname. And so he soon became the band's frontman and a local draw. And then Dave Bartholomew saw him, and he was like, he was incredible. You know, it's just, he had the audience in the palm of his hand. It was just a huge party. And he got him signed to Imperial Records. And those two collaborated until, I think, about 1963, and just produced hit after hit after hit. In 1986, Fats Domino was one of the first musicians to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he also received the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award that year. And in 1998, President Bill Clinton awarded him the National Medal of the Arts. He also had a very, like, unassuming, shy way about him. And because of that, many people think people may be aware of Fats Domino, but unaware of how large of a contribution he's actually made to rock and roll.
Thanks, Nikki. Well, you can hear more great music by artists influenced by Domino's legacy on VOA 1 The Hits. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Ain't that a shame? My tears feel like rain.
The music of Fats Domino. We're going to hear even more about him tomorrow on that show, so please listen. That is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The recent liberation of Raqqa by Syrian Democratic Forces, aided by the U.S.-led Defeat ISIS coalition, is a watershed moment in the fight against the terror group that had claimed invincibility. In the last days of the hard-fought battle for the city deemed by ISIS as the capital of its so-called caliphate, hundreds of ISIS fighters surrendered to the SDF, and years of ISIS cruelty and barbarity in the city ended. In announcing the victory, Lieutenant General Paul Funk, commander of Joint Task Force Operation Inherent Resolve, noted that Raqqa was a fortified prison during ISIS's occupation.
Terrorists operated with impunity and stunned the civilized world by televising torture, mass executions, and other unspeakable atrocities.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said in a statement that while the SDF and coalition forces continue to ensure ISIS is defeated militarily where it remains in Syria, a new phase is underway where the United States and its allies are working on stabilization efforts with local partners to provide assistance to liberated areas. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert spoke of the immediate priorities, including providing for the urgent humanitarian needs of internally displaced persons, IDPs, who have fled the city to surrounding areas.
Clearing the explosive remnants of war, such as IEDs and mines, from critical infrastructure such as hospitals, roads, and schools. Support efforts to establish basic security. Reestablish essential services such as water, electricity, health services, infrastructure rehabilitation to stabilize and promote a return to normalcy, and ultimately create the conditions to allow the voluntary safe return of Syrians to their homes.
The United States, she said, is also engaged in efforts to support local officials, such as the Raqqa Civil Council and the Tabqa Civil Councils, and their efforts to take over responsibility for post-liberation security and also governance, on the condition that they are representative, civilian-led, and credible in the eyes of the people they serve. The U.S. will also seek to de-escalate violence across Syria. As Secretary Tillerson said, reducing the violence in Syria will allow the United States, our allies and partners, to focus even more on advancing U.N.-led diplomatic efforts within the framework of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2254, aimed at reaching a genuine political transition that honors the will of the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.